Hi, and welcome to a brand new episode of DNA of Games, the podcast where I talk to other disabled and neurodiverse people working in the games industry. Joining me this week for a brand new episode is Lee Brady, who is a QA tester at a Chinese Room. Make sure you leave a like and follow wherever you may be listening or watching, and it really will help this podcast grow. Hi, and welcome to a brand new episode of DNA of Games, a podcast where I talk to other disabled and neurodiverse people that work in the games industry. And joining me today is Brady? Brandy?
Brandy.
Brandy.
That's fine. Whatever you want.
But Lee, who is a QA tester, specializing in accessibility over at Chinese Room. Brilliant introduction there, but I don't know if you want to give a little bit of a better intro.
I don't think I can top that. Hi, I'm Lee. My pronouns are they, them. And as Chris said, I am a QA tester at the Chinese Room. I'm generally, I'm both a QA tester and an accessibility specialist with QA. So I do QA that's centered around making games accessible for people. That's me.
That's me, Lee.
That's me. This is it. This is what you get.
But yeah, no, it's I think I met you at the winning Limit Break meetup, which I'm really excited. It was one of those like kind of accidental meets where I'm just like, oh, actually, yeah, like, you're somebody that I should really be talking to.
Yeah, so I was just sat there, right, with my walking stick, and I just saw you like look at me and like beelined and was like, oh my god, you have a power stick, and I was just like, hello, how are you? Because I felt really like it was a fantastic event, but at that moment I remember feeling like I was on my own for like, I don't know, like 5 minutes, because I just sat down because everybody was standing up and there were just chairs, but they were right at the back. So I was like, oh god, I'm absolutely knackered, I'll sit down. And then just in the corner of the room you were just there, and you're like, straight away.
But that's not a thing, like, you know, in your sticks sort of obviously signified to me that, like, you know, you're somebody who had like needed the for support, potentially with a disability, sort of identity, somebody who's comfortable bringing sticks as well, because I think a lot of people would just leave them at home and struggle through it. So like Harriet, who worked for me at Manycats, like one of the first encounters I had with her walking aid sticks, whatever you want to call them, and it was that sort of thing of not seeing many people in the industry that would quite actively use that at a networking event. So I felt it was quite a powerful thing that you actually were happy to sort of bring them along with you and just go, you know what, I'm effing tired, I'm gonna sit down, because like
I'm shattered,
networking sucks anyway. And you know, you always tend to try and fit into the networking mold and tie yourself out to fit in with like the able-bodied crowd and just tie yourself out more than what everybody else normally does. So that's, you know, the head I was just like, hello, in a really creepy way, because obviously I'm a man in the industry, so I've got to be creepy.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have that moment where you're like, okay, is this a normal conversation? But no, it's actually a really good point that you bring it up. I also had that sort of mentality. I think when I sort of first realized, because disability for me was kind of like, it was a process, because my mobility issues had gotten worse over time. So it was sort of a case of, I got to a point where I realized I needed to use a walking aid. And I remember going through so many walking sticks, because you have to find the right one. Like, nobody tells you this. It's about like the height and making sure they're comfortable in your hand. And I have like 10 sticks, and they're all for different occasions. Some of them are for different outfits. And for a while, I think there was sort of some, I guess, internalized ableism, because I was very much like that mentality of, oh, I don't need a walking stick. Like, and I would go out with friends or, you know, to events, and I wouldn't take it. And I would be in so much pain. I would be so tired. And then I'd come back and I'd be like, why did I not take my stick? And I think it was a bit of a process, because eventually I just got to that point where my moment, to hell with it. Like, I want to be comfortable. I want to be able to go to these networking events. I want to do whatever. And my stick goes with me whenever I need it. My conditions are fluctuating. I'll talk about them in a minute. But so sometimes I might not need them. It's a little more rare that I don't than I do nowadays, especially if I go out for a long time. Like that specific event, I think it was like, I want to say it was like a 3-4 hour event, and I was just like, there's no way I'm standing around for this. I was so thankful they even had chairs, because you never quite know. But they were fantastic with their accessibility, because I'd like when it comes to events like that, I have to check beforehand and be like, okay, do you have lifts? You know, do you have accessible ramps and things? Because even walking down steps is really difficult. It's like there's a lot of pain involved in that, and, you know, with a stick or without.
Yeah.
So ramps are one of those things where it's like they're actually a lot more useful for people, even if you aren't somebody who uses a wheelchair, for example. And a lot of people don't consider that. But, you know, the Limit Break was, the event was fantastic, and they were really good with their accessibility, and I was really grateful for it. But generally, yeah, in events, it's like, it used to be a case of, I would never take the stick. And there is a massive sort of, you know, stigma, I think, that you, I don't know if it's a general stigma. I don't know if that was a me thing where I would be like, I did not want to stand out. I didn't want people to look at me and be like, oh my God, you're the weird one that has a walking stick. And there's nothing weird or wrong with using a mobility aid. But I think that when you're first sort of, you know, you've gone from basically being what you considered an able-bodied person to a disabled person, the sort of internalized ableism that you have at first is just like it attacks you, and you're like, oh my God, is this wrong? But then it's very personal, because there has never ever been a time in my life where I've looked at somebody else with a stick and thought, that's weird. So I've never had that. It's just because it was me, because and that also comes down to like a self-esteem thing, and I think that's also what happens to a lot of people. But yeah, now stick goes with me whenever I need it. And, you know, and it's also useful if I need to bonk anyone on the head. So I love
Harriet
it.
Says the same thing. It's a useful weapon to sort of navigate the crowds.
Yeah, exactly. Just move people around.
But yeah, like, you know, again, I'm just thankful that we had that opportunity to actually meet. And, you know, now, you know, I'm interested about, you know, kind of why you came into games and how you came into games. You know, I think a lot of listeners will be quite intrigued to how you ended up as a tester.
So the reason, the why is I love games. I have been obsessed with games ever since I was super young. Like, oh my God, I was a Dreamcast kid. So I used to be very obsessed with things like Sonic Adventure, Shenmue. I still am obsessed with them. And Space Channel 5, Choo Choo Rocket, that sort of thing. And I also used to be really interested in a lot of PlayStation 1 games. When I was a kid, my brother had the PlayStation 1 and I wasn't allowed to touch it. And one of the things that he used to play that I loved was Tomb Raider. And I was obsessed with it, and I would just sit and watch all the time. And then it used to get to a point where he'd go to bed, my parents go to bed, and I'd be like sneaking down late at night playing Tomb Raider on the PlayStation, like looking around, like no one can see it, right? But because I didn't want anybody to know I'd been playing it, I couldn't save the game. So every single night I would just play the first level of Tomb Raider over and over. So I'm really good at that first level and not that good at the rest of the game. So that's sort of where it started. I also, like, I had a lot of instances like that where a lot of it was actually sort of my brother, he's 8 years older than me. So he was into a lot of that sort of thing. And he was older, so I sort of got to adopt it. I remember he used to borrow Game Boys and games off of his friends. Same sort of instance happened where his friend lent him Pokemon Red, and he would be like, hey, you can play it, but you can't save the game because you could only have one save on it, and it was his friend's save. So we would just, I think we got to like the second town or something on it, and we never got further because we would stop, have to do something, and have to start the game from the beginning. So that's sort of where it began. And it has just progressed into this obsession. If you can't tell already, I'm autistic. And that played a huge part in the fact that my special interest was games. It's one of my special interests. So that also helped me a lot as I was growing up. We didn't know I was autistic until I was an adult. I was an adult diagnosis for autism. So that's quite an interesting experience, because you go through your childhood with everybody sort of thinking you're weird and not knowing what's up with you. And you sort of have like a mourning period when you find out you're actually autistic. Not because, you know, I love being autistic. I love autistic people. I think we're incredible. We're basically superheroes as far as I'm concerned. Like, I would not change it for the world. But there is sort of like, there was a mourning period when I found out it's not because I was autistic. It was because I realized, oh my God, so many people treated me differently. And they didn't understand, or maybe they did understand and they didn't care, that there was something different about me. And maybe if I had known that when I was younger, the way I would have behaved or been with people could have been supported. But on the other side of that, because I didn't like, I had a lot of struggles socially with people because of it, a lot of my time went into games. I would be just like spending all my time alone playing games. I was just obsessed with them, and I would learn everything I could about a game. You know, I'd look up guides, look on, for a time there weren't wikis, like I'm that old, but when they I know, I feel so old, but when they started popping up and you got the fan wikis, I would just be hours. I'd just be like, oh my God, I need to find out everything about this. And especially horror games was specifically the thing that I got into. I actually used to have a folder full of, this is really embarrassing. I had this folder full of like, so in games like Silent Hill, Silent Hill 2, Fatal Frame, Resident Evil, you get like notes in the game, little snippets, pieces of paper. I had a folder of printed out transcripts of every single one of the notes for all of the games. I think the Silent Hill ones went up to Silent Hill 4. I can't remember how far the Resident Evil ones go, but that was sort of the era that I was playing. I had up to like Fatal Frame 3, and I would just sit there, and like when I wasn't playing games, I would just read through these transcript notes, and I would make notes myself, being like, maybe this means this. Is this connected? I was so obsessed with it. And I still am, on a different level. So yeah, that's the why of why I got into games, is because I'm crazy obsessed with games, and I'm crazy obsessed with a lot of games. I love interesting games. I love horror games, but I play everything. Yeah. As to how I got into games, this is exciting because I like talking about this because I'm not the only person who's probably gone through this, but it's a very unique experience. So I'm quite grateful for it. I have never had any kind of formal game experience. I have a degree, but it's not in anything game related. It's to do with like sociology, history and sciences. It's okay. There's nothing gamey in there. I did do one part of it is mostly like design and interactive media and things like that. So I did do something that was slightly gamey as part of it, but it's not like a gaming degree. That was something I got to choose and was like, I'm just going to make a tiny little game with tiny people. So no formal education, no experience. The only experience I've ever had in the games industry prior to what I do now is when I was in secondary school, I did a week's work experience at a place called Zoe Mode, where I tested something that was like a Guitar Hero game, and I also tested Disney Sing It. So I spent a week singing Disney songs, and I loved it. It was absolute, like, at that moment, I was like, this is where I want to work. This is what I want to do. But, like, no proper, you know, no proper experience. And I didn't know anyone either.
That's where my first question is, like, the Disney Sing It, what was your best song?
Oh my God, I don't know, actually. I think, because the thing is, it's such a blur, because it wasn't just like, you know, like what we think of, well, I don't know about you, but I think of Disney songs, I think of the ones from the animated movies. Mm. But I think the ones I was best at, they had like High School Musical, and I was obsessed with High School Musical when that came out. I went to the cinema to see it. I sung in the cinema. I used to have it, like, oh my God, I loved that. So it was probably the High School Musical.
We need just these High School Musical songs. I've got this.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I was just like, if anybody needs me to test any kind of Disney singing game, I'm here. But it was also a very funny experience because when I went to it, I think I did expect to do something else. I thought I'd be doing anything else, a racing game, a shooter. Mm. And they were just like, no, here, we're just making party games. And I had no idea, but it was a lot of fun. And it taught me a lot about how, at that time, how the industry sort of works. Because especially because I'm a non-binary person. And when I was there, it was all men, you know, it was all men. And it was, and it's changed a lot now, which also makes me feel old because this was obviously when I was a teenager. But it's such an interesting contrast compared to like that week of work experience I did to the sort of like studio I'm at now. You know, the industry is getting better. It is healing, which is fantastic. But yeah, so that's as far as I went. I didn't have anything proper, formal, nothing that you could just sort of go, give me a job in games. Mm. Now, the Chinese Room do something every single year called the entry scheme. It started, I want to say it started 2 years ago. So it was on the second year. and I applied for it. It's specifically designed to basically offer something like an apprenticeship or an internship to somebody who hasn't had any formal experience in game development, doesn't have the education, doesn't have the background, hasn't had the opportunities. But it's designed around, you know, but who would benefit? Who could you do for this? And it's very competitive, you know, as you can imagine. So hundreds of people apply for it.
So you imagine and applying and be like, I'm not getting this.
Oh my God. I did it on a whim. You know, like I was just like, I really like the studio. This sounds cool. I'll give it a go. And I remember I spent like a whole night. I stayed up till like 2 a.m. writing this application, just pouring my heart out and thinking nothing's going to happen. And it was quiet for a while because game studios are busy. And I think it must've been like a month, 2 months later, I hear back and they're like, hey, we want to get you in for an interview. And I was like, what? And I'm like pulling out my wardrobe being like, I have no proper clothes or anything. And it was a video interview, but I was just like, I have to look smart. And that was really funny because I had no idea. My only experience in work at that point had been professional jobs. You know, prior to that, I worked in an office, and prior to that, I worked in retail, which was hell. But everyone should do it so that they know.
Oh yeah, but
only for a week and then it'll stop.
Then
they'll know. But yeah, I was like, oh, I have to put on proper, you know, proper clothes for this interview. I have to be very proper and polite and everything. I remember like getting into that interview and everyone's been like, hey, you all right? And I was like, what is this? Like, what is happening? So I did the interviews and I got accepted and I did the entry scheme. And yeah, and I found out that game development was not as prim and proper as I thought, which was great. It's why I love it. And yeah, I did that for 6 months. So it's a 6 month scheme and it was for a QA position. So it was like just, it was like an internship QA that then goes into junior, that then goes, you know, goes on. And yeah, I did that. It was a really interesting experience. TCR are a fantastic studio. Like they really are a fantastic place to work. They're very accommodating for accessibility needs. They're very accommodating for neurodivergent individuals because it's a bit of a joke that I've said, like 9 times out of 10, you talk to somebody in the games industry, they're going to be neurodivergent. Like we are all just sort of drawn to it. We all have like different but similar stories about games and I feel like, you know, they're made by neurodivergent people. They attract neurodivergent people. Then the industry becomes rich with neurodivergent people. So, you know, they're fantastic for that. And I'm around a lot of people who I can work with. And I think that's very important because in previous jobs where they're a bit more regimented, it can be really difficult to work with people, not on an individual level, but you're trying to stick to this way of doing things, that way of doing things. Whereas where I work, we're very flexible about things and it's just a lovely environment. So yeah, I did 6 months of my entry scheme. Then they were just like, hey, we love you. Can you stay as our QA tester? And I was like, yes, I will.
Like, well, I'll think about it.
Yeah, I'm like, I'll think about it for like a whole second. Like, I'm not about to, no, I don't want that. But no, so I've now been with them for a while, not that long. I'm trying not to age myself. So just over a year now. And in my time, so after I sort of did, sort of during, but also after my entry scheme, I focused on doing my QA, I do general QA, but then I sort of delved into doing this specialism in accessibility because, you know, I'm a disabled person myself. I know a lot of disabled people. And one of the main things that sort of struck me when I came into the industry on this sort of professional level, we need accessibility. You know, there's so many people, I will say this, there's so many people here that yourself included who are doing things for accessibility and it fills me with so much joy. And every time I see it, I make them my friend, you know, like you're my friend now. Like I'm pulling you all together. We're all in this sort of like this bubble I have of accessibility people, but because we're all sort of here, there, everywhere doing it. There's no sort of general over accessibility thing in the industry right now. You know, there still needs to be more set standards. We still need to have more regulations. We still have to basically make it so that every game comes out has, you know, X, Y, and Z a standard and then improves on it. But there's not a lot in place for that at the moment. And I was like, okay, you know, if it's not there, I'm gonna do it. So I started sort of basically applying for every talk, lecture, every kind of everything. I even attended your talk on auditory accessibility and all, you know, webinars. I love it. And I still do it because my thing is that, you know, as a specialist, and I would say that, you know, I'm at this point where I can call myself a specialist. I'm regarded as a specialist. But you cannot stop learning about it, because especially with, I think it's true for a lot of things, but especially with accessibility, there will always be new needs that arise.
Yeah.
There will always be new things that you need to account for. And also, I'm disabled in very specific ways. And, you know, yourself, you have a disability that I do not have. So I cannot possibly know every single thing there is to know, say, for about auditory accessibility, which is why I need to then do things in order to inform myself of this, or consult with other people and get more feedback. It's like you have to be in this sort of constant mindset of always learning about accessibility in order to be good at providing, you know, enough information and to consult about accessibility. So yeah, that's sort of where I'm at now, is that I am the crazy accessibility person who loves to shout about it. I very passionate about accessibility QA, because the thing about accessibility QA is it's not done enough. There is a lot of games that implement accessibility features and it's fantastic. It's great. And a lot of the time they're tested by able-bodied people and they're signed off, and they're not always quite right, because people might think, oh, this is a really good idea, this will help that person, I've read an article that said this is really useful for these people. But if you actually go to somebody who has that disability and have them test it, you know, you might find out that maybe the way you designed it is not quite accurate, it's not quite the way that it needs to be.
Yeah.
And I think it's incredibly important to hire people who are disabled, who have physical difficulties, cognitive difficulties with playing games, because that's the only way you're going to be able to make a game that includes everybody in it. I have hand problems. I do a lot of stuff with my hands, you might notice. It's because my hands are actually in a constant state of pain and they cramp a lot, so I have to keep them moving. But if I hold a controller for too long, because you're generally in sort of a static position and your hands are sort of like this, as a result, my hands tend to seize up and they're incredibly painful. Most of the time when I play games, I have to wear compression gloves, and that only takes off like the tiniest amount of pain, but it does help. And as a result, you know, for me, there are things that I can't do. I cannot mash buttons. Stop putting mash buttons in your game. And if you do, you know, have a toggle for hold, because oh my God, I cannot mash buttons. Sometimes I try and play old games with like button mashes and I'm like, no, this is not happening. I just turn it off. But you know, but that's me. I could not, you know, I can consult to the best of my ability on something that I do not experience, you know, like auditory accessibility, or, you know, or blindness, for example. You know, I have as far as my sight goes, I have to wear glasses. If I do this, I cannot see you, but I'm not blind, you know, and I could do to the best of my ability to consult for what I know about, you know, blindness and blindness accessibility. But you will always do better to actually, if you go, I want to design something for a blind person to be able to play my game, get a blind person to test it. You're always going to be able to have the best result if you go directly to the person that you're trying to make the game for, you know. And we can only, I understand games, we have budgets, we have timelines, okay, but you have to account for these things in order to make the games accessible. So I will hush about that now, because I could go on for hours. But basically, hire more accessibility testers who have disabilities. That's what I'm saying, and that's what I do.
I mean, you know, that's an excellent point, and it is like, you know, it really is simple as that. Like, you know, sort of diversifying the staff, you know, helps you know, mitigate sort of that sort of like, you know, the variety in QA testers means that you can have that variety of viewpoints coming into testing the game. I guess, you know, I'd be interested in kind of know of how your role is, the challenges of your role with knowing, because obviously you're very aware that you'd be great at some testing some accessibility features, but others it's like
because you don't live with that, or you know, it's just not, you know, your specialism within a specialism. Like, I always feel like, you know, I'll be great at saying hard of hearing deaf things, but you know, like you say, visual, you know, gaming without sight, you know, I'm not going to be the best at. I'll give you the clip notes, but in reality, there's other people out there that, you know, are the experts that you should be tapping into. So, you know, how does that, you know, having that, you know, viewpoint affects kind of like how you do your role? Because obviously, they would love to hire, you know, whatever, every tester.
Yeah.
But it
is a case of budgets that we can't just have, you know. But it, well, I say can't. I think that that's personally a bit of an industry issue, and I might touch on that later. But yeah, I mean, it does affect me in the sense that, you know, when I do my testing sort of regime is generally, I test normally. And by that, I mean, you know, I do QA test roles, but I cannot get away from the fact that I have my disabilities. Mm. So when I'm testing, I am testing with that in mind regardless, because I, you know, that I'm one of the people on the team who will be like, I can't do this. And everyone else on my team might be like, we can do it fine. And I'm like, that's not my point. I cannot do this because I have, you know, XYZ problem. So this needs to be considered, because I can then, you know, if it works for me, it would work ideally for somebody who has the same problem. But one of the things that I do tend to do is I do tend to do a lot of testing with disability, accessibility in mind. And I consider those, like, you know, they're the two core components, because what I mean by that is the disability part of my head goes, okay, how would this work for somebody who has this disability? And then the accessibility part of my brain is like, what is the accessible option we can provide to make it work for that person? Yeah. And it's one of those things you have to do with quite a lot of thought, because, you know, like I said, I'm not blind. So when I'm playing a game, I have to stop and be like, could you do this if you were blind? And it's very interesting, actually. My partner was playing a game the other day. It was The Evil Dead, which is a online multiplayer horror game. And it was an absolute fantastic moment where they had their headset on and they're playing the game, and they took it off and was like, oh my God. And I'm looking at them like, what? And they're like, my audio has gone. My entire audio. And they were like, but everything is working fine. And I was like, oh, it must have glitched, you know, as games do and online ones tend to do. Now, I think initially they were like, oh, I'll quit the game and I'll start it up. But they went, actually, no, hold on. I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to give it a go. And they played an entire match using just visual, you know, cues on the screen. And they did it, you know, I was actually really proud. They did it. They completed the match. They helped save the book and everything. It was fantastic. But they were so happy at the end because they felt really accomplished, because they were like, oh, wow, I did that entirely based on what I saw. I couldn't hear anything, because it's quite, there are a lot of audio cues in that game. It tells you when the enemies are popping in. It tends to tell you, you know, where items are. I know the items make an actual sound when you go near them, but it also does show on screen. And no, that in that sense, they don't have any visual impairment and they don't have hearing impairment. So for them, it was, you know, they were able to do it normally fine, but they were still able to play the game despite it having a glitch that was like, you can't hear anything. And they did say something to me where they were like, oh my God, this made me realize how difficult games must be for people who are deaf, especially because if they didn't have this information on screen, they would not be able to play this game. And I'm just sat there smiling like, that's accessibility for you.
you get a cookie today.
Yeah, I was just like, that's what accessibility is for. But it was a really nice moment to sort of like, because I play that game briefly, but not like, you know, like in a casual sense in my own personal time, not on like an official like level. So it was nice for me to see that it was an accessible game for people, that, you know, you could have these visual cues on screen that meant even if you could not hear a thing, you could still play it. Now, I don't know if it works the other way around. I don't know if you could play that without seeing it, because it's a very like, you know, visual heavy game. Mm. And I don't think a lot of the like auditory parts of that game are directional, but I'm not sure. There might be modes to it. I'll be honest, I have not been able to have a look at that yet, but I'm planning on it, because I think that it was quite interesting. But yeah, but that in mind, that sort of, you know, that feels like that's a lot of what I'm trying to do, is considering, you know, I might not have this disability, but if somebody who does have this disability, how would this affect them? And that's the key thing you sort of have to remember. And it goes back to what I was saying about you have to constantly be teaching yourself as well. I feel like to be a specialist in accessibility is that, like, in order for me to be able to provide an experience for somebody that, you know, works for them, regardless of their needs or disabilities, I need to know as much information as possible about those conditions, about those disabilities, about the needs that people have. And by doing that, I'm just in a constant state of just being like, I'm going to every single talk I see, I'm talking to as many people as I can. And I love picking people's brains, if they let me. I've talked about this like a lot of times with a lot of people. I'm very conscious of the sort of balance between, I want to know all the information I could possibly do, but also disabled people do not owe you all the information about everything, because we are exhausted, you know? So, you know, you've got to keep a boundary, and it's very difficult to find that balance, but it's very important to keep that balance and to keep it in mind, because, you know, disabled people are the best people to tell you about things, but also you cannot expect disabled people to give you all the information. I think it's one of those things about marginalized groups in general. You cannot always expect it to, like, them to give up all the information you need. You have to research, you have to do your own work, you know? Yeah. And accessibility is very much that. And, you know, there'll be nights where I'm just sat looking at articles, looking at information online, just reading about different disabilities that people have, because it's interesting to understand how that can then affect in games. Because also there are a lot of games that, you know, there's a lot of accessibility features we don't even have. And it's one of these things I love to talk about to people when I meet them and I talk about accessibility, is I like to say, you know, what do you want that isn't there? Because it's really hard, I think, for a lot of people when they start thinking about it, because everybody sort of thinks, oh, well, we have subtitles, we have some games that let you change the color of the HUD or your whatever. Some people have visual cues, some games have like audio cues, but what don't we have that we need? You know, for me, something I've been thinking about lately is having games that have a lot of loud noises and flashing lights and things like that. I've been sort of trying to wrap my brain about what possible accessibility issues we could have with that, with people who have PTSD, because I was thinking about, you know, is there a way that games can incorporate specific modes for people with PTSD so that it's sort of I guess like quieten sounds, maybe reduces the sort of levels of those sounds and the lights and the sort of imagery you get. Not so much that it derives from the game, but enough that it makes the game playable. But it's definitely just something that's sort of rattling around in my head, because I feel like we don't have a lot of games that take that into account. And we have a lot of games that have a lot of flashing lights and a lot of loud noises. And, you know, that in turn, the thing about accessibility is that in turn can then also benefit somebody else.
Yeah.
So I know issues with flashing lights could also affect people who have epilepsy or, you know, tend to have reactions. So you tend to find that if you start making accessibility options for one group of people who like this disability, it then sort of dominoes into another disability, because we have so many symptoms that are across a lot of disabilities.
I mean, you know, like I always say, like, you mentioned subtitles there. I mean, that's such a standard how everybody plays games or watches Netflix or anything like that. Like, a majority of people put subtitles on now because that's just kind of the default setting that they kind of want. So it's not necessarily like a, oh, because everybody's now deafened and hard of hearing. It's more a case of like, oh, you know, it's a way for me to process information, because I'm, you know, sort of sitting here concentrating on, right, what they're all saying, you know, am I catching every word that they're saying, the information that they're, you know, it's been relayed to me. Like, it just got to ease up on that, like, expending all your energy to concentrate on the game to learn things. It's just like, oh, it's just written there, I can actually just read it as I'm going along to sort of process that information. So it's really interesting, like, to, like, exactly like you said, like, how accessibility features are just become the commonplace thing, because it just makes that experience with the game just so much better for everybody.
It's really good, and it's I'm really happy to see that accessibility features are more prevalent than ever. And it is, but I will always say there's always work to be done. There's always more we can do. But like you said, with the subtitles thing, what's really nice about that is exactly what you said. It's normal. Now, I know the normal is a bit of an awful word. I hate it. But it is the norm. A lot of people I know have absolutely no problems with, like, you know, hearing their shows, but they love having their subtitles on because they know for sure what they're gonna, you know, be able to hear. They're making sure that if somebody is a bit quiet, they know what they're saying, and also it just sort of clarifies things. And I think a lot of people, and myself included, when they watch shows, they rewatch shows with subtitles, sometimes there's a word that you thought you heard that isn't that word at all, and you're like, oh my god, they're actually saying this, which I love. But because it's normal, because it's become like a very commonplace thing,
yeah,
it makes everybody feel more comfortable. You know, like, one of the things about accessibility is that it might, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there has never been an accessibility feature that hurts anyone. You know, if you are an able-bodied person with no issues, you are not going to be affected by, you know, me having the ability to, I don't know, change the colors of my HUD, like I said. But I am going to be able to look at my game better and actually be able to see what I'm doing. And one of those things that's really nice about that is, in turn, I think Fallout New Vegas is really good for this, and the Fallout 3 as well, I think, also had it, where you could change the color of your HUD. And I know people that would just change the color for fun. They, you know, they had no sort of need for it. So they'd be like, oh, I just want a pink HUD. And I'd be like, I'd change it to like blue or orange, depending on the game, because New Vegas was a very orange looking game. So I had a blue HUD as a contrast. And I think Fallout 3 was a very bluey green game. So I had an orange HUD for contrast. So I could actually see what I was doing. So I'm sat there going, oh my god, I can play this game. I'm having such a good time, I can actually play it. And they're going, hee hee, look at my pink HUD. And I'm like, we're both happy. You know, what's the problem? Exactly. You do not lose anything by making your game more accessible for people. You just make it more accessible for people. You know? Yeah. And it's, I think it's a really important thing for people to remember that.
No, though, that, you know, exactly that, and that's kind of like, you know, that's the sound bite. You know, that's the, but it's like, it just, it's like one of the things that just needs to keep reiterating to sort of go against that tide of the, you know, gamer bros saying, oh my god, you're ruining the game and you're ruining the game. So it's like, no, we're not, calm down.
I do have this thing that I will say in relation to that, is that there are games that people tend to say that accessibility features are cheating. It tends to be multiplayer games. And quite honestly, I don't care. I don't care if you think that, because it's not true, right? If somebody is having genuine difficulty with doing something in a game and an option allows them to then do it with ease, that's fine. And if an able-bodied person can play that game without those accessibility options and they don't have to toggle it and they play the game fine, that's fine. Now, the worry is that they feel like an able-bodied person would click on something and suddenly become amazing at the game. And I assure you, 9 times out of 10, there aren't accessibility features that we have that are magically going to make people better at the game. You know, changing your screen for color blindness is probably not going to make you better at headshots. You know, like, it's just, it's a very strange mentality. But like, when I say I don't care and I'm just like, just deal with it, it's because, like, if that does happen, if there is an accessibility feature that somehow makes somebody able-bodied be able to click something and be better, I would rather that they quote unquote cheat, as people like to call it, and mean that other people can go play that game and have fun, than feel any kind of like, oh my god, you've got somebody in your game who's slightly better because they're using a feature. Like, it makes no sense to me, because at the end of the day, I know people play games competitively. I know that people treat games in a very sort of, especially multiplayer games, in that sort of very serious mindset. And that's fine if that's you, that's fine. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, games are designed to have fun and people should be having fun. And if you're gatekeeping that fun for people, that's a problem. Because, you know, are you having fun with your game? If you're getting upset about that sort of thing, because if you're not, maybe take a look at the games you're playing and be like, you should play something else.
Oh, this is why Lee's got the sticks to bash down the gates.
Respond. Yeah, let people play games.
Yeah, just sort of moving on to sort of like, you know, sort of your identity. I know you've had dropped a lot of sort of how you are and how you play games. And also mentioning, like, obviously you've evolved with your like diagnosis and that, and even like a very typical industry thing of learning about your neurodivergence in later on in life is a very common trend in the industry, where people are like, I knew there was something quite not, I'm not like, you know, my brain doesn't function the way everybody else does, but, you know, no one ever really sort of, you know, diagnosed me as like ADHD or autistic. And it was like only after I met other ADHD people or autistic people that I realized, oh, this makes a lot more sense now.
Yeah.
So yeah, how, like, you know, pretty much the same, but like, you know, that sort of like, how have you sort of come into owning your like disabled and neurodivergence identity? It sounds like it was something more recent that you've kind of been like, yeah, this is me. The middle finger to anyone that's
So, I mean, I've been aware of the autism for a while. I'm not going to say how long, because that will make me, that means I have to date myself, and I don't want to know how old I am. But like I said, I was diagnosed with autism as an adult. When I was around about the same time, about maybe a year or so after I was diagnosed with autism, I developed a chronic illness. And then I had developed two chronic illnesses at the same time, which is very unfortunate, very horrible experience. But I had an awful lot of difficulty in getting my diagnosis for both these conditions separately. So I was diagnosed with, and I'm going to say it slowly because I always struggle to say this because it's such a long word, myalgic encephalomyelitis, which is a condition that basically, it's one of those things where I say it's exhausting to talk about because it's an exhausting condition. It essentially means that I am exhausted all the time. I don't have refreshing sleep. So when I sleep and I wake up, I very rarely feel like I've slept. It also comes with cognitive difficulties. You tend to have common phrases, brain fog, where you just do not... It's like just having a fog over you all day. You're just talking and words are not even coming out correctly. I have memory issues as a result of it. So I might not remember something. I could not remember something 5 minutes later, or I might not remember something from months ago. It's very difficult to actually deal with that part, because I think memory loss is something that people don't talk enough about as being quite a scary condition that a lot of people experience as a part of a lot of bigger conditions. And it's not nice, you know, it's horrible to sort of be like, I can't remember this information you just gave to me. It also has something that you experience as part of it called post-external malaise, which is essentially when you do any kind of physical exertion. This doesn't have to be exercise. It can be exercise, but it could be as simple as walking to the shop. It could be as simple as, you know, just going down the stairs. It depends on how you are that day. But basically you do a physical task, and as a result, your body punishes you for it and you are just absolutely wiped out. And depending on what it is, it can take a day, it could take a week. In some cases, it could take months that you are just complete, you cannot do anything. You are just stuck in bed. You know, physically exhausted. You can't even like lift your arms and legs. And it's one of those things where it's hard to determine what will happen. So I could probably say at this point, I've had the condition long enough that I can generally say, if I do this task, it will probably have me wiped out for this long. So say if I go out to a show, I probably would be completely wiped out for a few weeks and then wouldn't be able to do anything that I would want to do. I wouldn't be able to do any social events. I wouldn't even be able to do this, you know, like I wouldn't be able to do anything like this because I would just be, I'd be in that bed, just wiped out. And it's incredibly difficult because you can't really look after yourself in that. You end up relying on a lot of other people for support. You know, it's quite hard to be independent when you have those sorts of issues. And it's just never certain. So I could say that. I could say, oh, it will probably take a few weeks. But I never know if I'm going to wake up and that's going to be, that's it, I'm out for a month, I'm out for 2 months.
Wow.
And the thing about ME, which is the shorthand version of it, is that it's a fluctuating condition. Mm. So when I first had it, I had it very intensely and I was bedbound for months at a time. It happened sort of, it happened fast, but it happened slowly, if that makes, it's very hard to explain. Like, it happened over a course of like a month or two.
Yeah.
But when I look back, it feels like it was fast. Like, I was getting very bad very quickly.
Yeah.
And to the point that I was just stuck in bed. And I remember my parents had bought me a cat. They had bought me a cat from a rescue place. And she was my only companion during that time. I was completely bedbound. And all I had was this little cat. And she's like, I was lucky because I was with my parents at the time. They would help me feed her at this point, and you know, I didn't have to do too much, but we became very, very close because she looked after me by being my companion, because that was all I had. I was just stuck in bed. I couldn't even really play games. I couldn't read. I was just, it's a horrible experience. Mm. Like, I cannot overemphasize how horrible it is to be stuck in bed with nothing that you can do. I think some people have this sort of mentality of like, oh, it's so lovely to be all under the covers and cozy. And like, there is a massive difference, I tell you, between wanting to have an extra couple of hours in the morning and being stuck in a bed for a month. Mm. Like, it's horrible. But with ME, it's generally an exhaustion thing. So you're very tired all the time. As well as ME, I have a comorbid condition called fibromyalgia. Fibromyalgia is a little bit more commonly known. It tends to basically, it's a widespread, there's a word for it. I want to say it's like musculoskeletal. I can never say.
Medical word, I'm just like, no, I'm not going to attempt that.
it's something to do with your muscles and your skeleton. But basically, it's pain. And essentially, fibromyalgia means that you're constantly in pain, which I am. Again, I'm in constant pain right now. But it tends to be, so there are pressure points at which the pain happens, and they believe, from a lot of stuff that I've, you know, looked, because you have to research a lot of your conditions, because the doctor will tell you have something and then that's it. You know, they're like, good luck. So generally it's believed that it causes problems through your pain receptors in your brain, but also in your spine. And it's sort of a two-pronged attack, basically. It makes pain happen where it shouldn't. So it messes with the signals where your body tells you that you shouldn't feel pain from something and makes it hurt. And it makes pain worse. So the things that do hurt, so, you know, if somebody, I don't know, like, just punched me, it would, I mean, a punch is going to hurt, but it would hurt me so much worse. Even like a flick or a nudge hurts like a punch. So anything more would be like debilitating. And the thing about having fibro and ME together is it's this beautiful double whammy, and I use the word beautiful, not literally, of constant exhaustion and constant pain.
Yeah.
And I've had this quite a while. And in turn, this causes a lot of other problems that I have that then lead to the mobility issues. One of the reasons why I use the walking stick is because I'm exhausted and I'm also in pain. And the walking stick does help relieve some of that. It relieves a lot of the pressure that is on my legs. My legs are the worst place for having pain and for having exhaustion. Like, there'll be days I wake up and I, even at work, I will have to say, I am so sorry, I can't come in, my legs aren't working. And it is, yeah. It's not even a joke, because there are people who be like, yeah, my legs aren't working. And I'm like, no, my legs are not working. I'm quite lucky because I can use my laptop for work. So a lot of the time when I have days like that, I would just be in bed like that, laptop right up here on my chin, and I'm just testing away best I can. But it's a very sort of interesting experience because the conditions fluctuate. You never know what you're going to get. Now, I'm not saying that's not a good thing, but it's also very humbling, I would say, and it's definitely changed a lot of how I am as a person, because you sort of become a lot more accepting and understanding of people when you have to be more accepting and understanding of yourself. I mean, my life essentially slowed to a crawl when I got sick. because I had to start taking things very slowly. I had to start taking a lot more extra care. And I admit, maybe I don't even take enough care as I should. You know, I definitely do some more stuff than I should, which I think is, you know, I've said this to you before, it's game dev 101. You're always doing stuff. But I do have to take a lot more breaks than other people. And it's very hard. And it's been very difficult when I first was diagnosed, because like I spoke about earlier about the sort of internalized ableism, I think that it also, it's sort of like, I would say it set me back, but I don't really think that's true. But I think for ease of conversation, it sort of set me back a few years. So I started going so much slower than everyone else around me. So even getting into the games industry, I've gotten into the games industry a lot older than a lot of people who are in the industry. And sometimes I've had that moment where I'm like, oh my God, I've done this too late. But then you realize it's never too late to do things. You know, stuff will happen when you need to. You just got to take the time you need.
Yeah, I guess people will be interested to know, like, kind of how you felt in terms of, like, oh, you know, getting all these, like, oh, you got this diagnosis and this diagnosis now, and you're thinking, oh my God, it's all stacking up. Like, how did you feel? Like, you think, oh, is this going to really hamper my career? Like, you know, wanting to get into games and actually, you know, sort of do well, like, in your job. Like, I assumed that there must have been a point where you were like, what the hell am I going to do with all this? How am I going to function as an employee, like, any game dev studio?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think I'd be myself if I sat here and tried to pretend that it was anything different. When I got diagnosed with one thing, it was so hard to envision a future. And then you get diagnosed with something else, you're like, oh my God, you know, like, it's so much at once. So the thing about the conditions, I will just add, is that there is no cure for these conditions. There's nothing you can do other than pain management and lots of rest and just taking it easy, and just doing your best basically to manage it how you can. But because of that, especially when I was told that there is nothing that they could do, I was like, my life's over. You know, what am I gonna do? At the time I got diagnosed, I wasn't working. I was working in a retail store, and I had a back problem, and that back problem ended up with me finding out about my diagnosis, because it sort of went into this whole thing where it was like, you're exhausted all the time, like, you have all these problems. I'm like, yeah, isn't that normal? And it got progressively worse, and I was in bed stuck there for ages, and I was, you know, there'd be moments where I'd be like, I'm not going anywhere, I'm not going to be able to do all the things I wanted to do. And I've always wanted to be in game development ever since I was little. There are also other things that I've always wanted to do that over time, you know, like I used to want to do voice acting. I used to want to make YouTube videos, and I did for a little while, but then I got sick and then I couldn't do it anymore. And it was just like, oh my God, you know, like, my whole world has just fallen apart. But I will say that I'm not going to sit here and be like, it's all in your head and you got to get it. No, it's hard. It's hard. There's no sugarcoating it. And it is very much a case of you just keep going, even if it's hard. And even if you feel awful, if you keep pushing forward, because I think there was something for me that was very much like, what do I have to lose? You know, like, this is how it is. And it cannot really get much worse than this. I don't overexert myself to the point of, like, you know, overworking. Yeah. I have had problems with that in the past, because, you know, you want to do a lot of stuff. And I'm quite lucky. I have a very good support network where, you know, I have, like, my partner, and I have people around me who will be like, just stop. You are doing too much. It's very important to know your limits.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard, and it was a very long process. And I will say, you know, it took years and years for me to get to where I am now, even just with my conditions, not, you know, work aside, game dev aside, just as myself. And, you know, like you said, I do tend to own it. You know, I'm very proud of who I am, and I do not make any, I make no apologies for being a disabled, you know, neurodivergent person. I have mental health conditions as well. You know, I'm very open and accepting of who I am, but it was never always like that. And it's a very long process. And I think one of the key things about this is just, like I said, pushing forward, and you'll get to that point where you're like, you will do it. The thing is, right, when you have these difficulties, you realize that, you know, it doesn't stop you being who you are.
Yeah.
And if you, you know, we all have talent, we all have ambition, and I'm an incredibly ambitious person. And before I got sick, I was a lot, you know, a lot more like go, go, go. And I still am, but I'm also very slow about going. So, you know, it didn't really change me. It just changes how you view the world, how you sort of, you know, realize what your limits are.
Yeah.
And like I said, you just got to keep going for it, because it's not going to be easy.
But well, I say, like, you know, to like employers or even students, like, kind of like, taking the risk with a disabled or neurodiverse person, it's kind of like, actually, these employees will be the people that have the most resilience.
Yeah.
And or have the most, you know, sort of probably will have the most adaptability to the changing landscape of development. You know, they'll be able to process things a lot better than most people, because they just have to. It's part of their day-to-day life, of being adaptable and resilient to kind of how crap the world can be.
you are right. There's so many things that we as disabled people just have to put up with, and it is one of those things where I'm like, I completely agree, but I'm also like, but employers need to be better, and they need to make more accommodations for us, because I tell you, right, for every single disabled person, yourself included, they're so talented that I've met in this industry. They're so talented, they're so passionate, and they just want to do great things for the industry. And those are the people you want in the industry. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, make the space for them. We're not risks. I have heard that, and it's so ridiculous, because there is nothing risky about a disabled person. They will be so dedicated. And I do think that, like, this is a bit of a mixed bag about how to take this, because I'm very like on two sides about this, because it shouldn't be this way, but it is. As disabled people, I think that we tend to work very, very hard, because we feel like it's harder for us in the industry, because, you know, it is harder for us because we're considered as a risk. We're not noticed as much as able-bodied people. Yeah. You know, we have some people regard us as being, you know, troublemakers, because we ask for certain things. It's like, I could not be the furthest thing from a troublemaker, you know, but it's like people think that we are all sorts of negative connotations about disabled people because, you know, we need adjustments and such. But, it, you know, we, because of all of this, it does, unfortunately, but I guess in a way, fortunately, mean that we work extra hard, because we want to be like, hey, look, we're really, really, really good at what we do. We're really passionate, and we feel like we have an internalized have to prove ourselves. Now, it shouldn't be like that. It should not be like that, as far as I'm concerned. We should all be, you know, considered as we are. That's why I'm very grateful for where I work, because nobody like feels that way, and everybody's just very chill. But unfortunately, the industry is like that as a whole. And I will say, like, it's probably the least risky thing is to have a disabled person on your team.
Oh, I just like that. At the end of the episode, we normally like to ask people kind of like their standout gaming moment, or the, you know, the thing that they always sort of think about when someone says, oh, what's your favorite game? And it, you know, I'm being that person and asking you that thing of like, you know, if I said there's a particular moment in gaming which is just like, yeah, I that's the thing that makes me so passionate and love games, is when I played Tomb Raider and did the first level.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, that was a standout moment for me in games as Tomb Raider. There's a lot of games that I have standout moments for. I'm very diverse about the sort of games I play, and the sort of games I like always changes. I do all the genres. I will say, in terms of like my actual favorite game, I have never shifted on this in my entire life since I've played it. And it's Earthbound, which was on the SNES. And I love Earthbound. It was part of the Mother series, and the Mother series as a whole is fantastic, but Earthbound stuck out to me because it was the first one I played, And I actually remember when I was a kid, we didn't have a SNES. My dad set up like a little SNES emulator on our computer. So I played it through that. It was called Z-SNES. It was fantastic. And I was just obsessed. It was one of those games where I was like, I didn't know games could be like this. And I had come from not as far ahead as we are now, obviously, but I had come from like this generation of having PlayStation 1, Dreamcast. My main console after the Dreamcast was the Xbox original. So that was the sort of era of gaming that was for me. Mm. So going back to something that was so sprite based, even for me at that time, I was like, whoa, I didn't know that games used to be like this. And I loved it. You know, I thought it was fantastic. But Earthbound particularly was just really special to me because it was so strange at the time. You know, it was like you were the hero of the story, but you were also just a kid with a baseball bat, you know, and there was this girl with you who just happened to show up for some reason. You go rescue her and then she's part of your team. And it was so strange because I remember like one of my favorite towns and it has like zombies walking all over the place and it has like a big zombie circus tent. And I just loved it. I remember there was a cult in it that's full of people who like to paint themselves blue. Like it was so weird. It was so weird. And it was also sort of, I would say probably my first sort of look into very Japanese style games and how their sort of games tend to be a lot more abstract than ours, especially around that time. And you know, now as an adult, I go back and play, specifically I tend to play a lot of Japan only games that are so weird, so bizarre, and I love it. I think it's fascinating. I just really love games that are eccentric and strange. And specifically with Earthbound, it's quite a nice experience because it was also one of my first experiences with that sort of like turn-based combat of you fighting the enemy in that format. And I was never a Final Fantasy person growing up. I only got into Final Fantasy as an adult. So when I played Earthbound, that was my thing. And then I tend to, for some reason, I managed to play every single JRPG that wasn't Final Fantasy. So I play like Grandia and Skies of Arcadia. And I remember like people would come to me like as an adult, like, oh my God, which Final Fantasy is your favorite? And I'm like,
what's that?
And then I found out and I was like, oh my God, like what is this? And to be fair, like I still don't entirely get into Final Fantasy. I play the online one, which I really love, and I love some of the other ones, but a lot of it is what me and my partner call nerd osmosis. So I haven't like completed any of the I've completed a couple of it, but no, I the ones I liked were the sprite ones. I think it was Final Fantasy 4 that I really enjoyed, but I haven't say completed Final Fantasy 7. I think it looks nice from afar, and I know everything that happens because of nerd osmosis, but I've never actually completed it myself. I think I tried to play it once and it just didn't gel for me. So Earthbound's my favorite, but yeah, there's just a lot of games. I remember when I was a kid, my brother played Silent Hill in front of me, and I was far too young at the time to have been watching that. And I remember it's even the opening segment, there's like a body, it's all ripped apart, and I just sat there and I was like,
I had that exact same experience, only my Silent Hill was Resident Evil 2.
it's so perfect, right? Because you have that moment where you're like, I really shouldn't be watching this, but it changes your world. Because from that point, like I ended up having nightmares after that for a while, and everyone was really worried about me. And then I was like, I'm just going to become obsessed with this. And then here I am, absolutely obsessed with horror games and everything about them. And, you know, Silent Hill's still a fantastic game series, but it's just so key in my mind to think that's sort of where that started, was just sitting there watching my brother play, and he had no idea. You know, he was just like, oh, I'm just gonna show you this horror game that's like he was actively, because he was one of these brothers that like to sort of wind me up, so I think he trying to scare me. I think he was trying to sort of like make me scared and be like, oh my God, and run away. And he didn't expect me to just be sat there like, oh my God, I'm obsessed with this. This is amazing. I think he was surprised I didn't run out the room right away. And I remember just watching him play the entire game. Every time he played it, I would just sort of be like, because we used to have conjoining rooms. So you would have to walk through my room to get to his. So I would be there like at the door and I'd be like, oh my God, that sounds like the game. And I'd be like, can I come in and watch you? That's really key to me, and definitely where that horror obsession started as well.
Oh, that's like, I like how you got going eclectic, like from the, you know, the boundaries of it all, but also the horrorness of it all. And that's the thing,
this is me.
This is why I kind of hate that sort of, like, you know, what your favorite game is, because I think different games are your favorite for different reasons.
Yeah.
Exactly, kind of how you put it, was like why you loved certain things, like, for certain reasons. And, you know, that's why, this is why I ask people, is because it makes people think of, like, oh, this and that, but this as well.
Yeah, honestly, I cannot talk about games without going super into games, because it's like, there's so many games I've played, and I don't mean that as a flex, because if anything, it's hard to keep track of everything I played, because what will happen is somebody will mention something, and then, like, that, it will just go in my brain, and a core memory will come out, and I'm like, oh my god, I used to play this. This was amazing. Or I remember this from that point in my life. And it's just, I think it's fantastic. I love talking to people about games, because I just think they are so important in people's lives, especially of, like, these are like our sort of generations, and yeah, especially now the younger generations, they're so sort of like pinnacle to, you know, us as a society.
Yeah,
you know, it's a very normal thing. Everyone plays games, and we all have these sort of different memories of them. And I love talking to people in game dev about it, because sometimes I'll meet people who have been in the industry for a very long time, and they talk about games I've never heard of that were from when games started, and I'm like, oh my god, that's incredible, you know. And then on the reverse side, I've had people in the industry who are so young, and they ask me about games, and I tell them, and they go, I've never heard of that, that's before my time. And I'm just like,
like, oh, I'll my just god, go I'm away so and old. Die now.
Yeah. And then, but then I get over that, and I go, all right, I'm gonna teach you something, and I just bring out the catalogue of games.
It's like, thank you, old person of the industry.
Everything's a teachable moment.
But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure to get to know you, your life, really. Like, it's like, you know, and, you know, the fact that you're so passionate, and, you know, you will be a game changer in the industry. I think you will be one of those people that helps push it in the right direction. You're probably hitting over the head with the stick, just like, nope, we're doing this. We're changing for the better. We're not going back there in the backlands. But
oh,
yeah,
I hope so.
But thank you for being a part of DNA of Games and being a part of this episode. Is there anything you'd like to sort of plug, any socials or content you want people to be aware of that you're making?
Oh god, it's like this moment where I'm like, do I make content? Yeah, yeah, so please, anybody who's watching this who thinks I'm fun or great or anything, you can check out my Twitter. That's basically where I put everything that I do, goes to my Twitter. And I also have a YouTube channel. They're both at Wired Usagi. My YouTube channel is specifically sort of like video essays and deep dives. I've only just started it, so there's not much there, but there's gonna be. I've got stuff planned, so it's great. So, but mostly, if you want to find out what I'm doing, go on my Twitter, because it is a nice mix of very professional game dev stuff and pictures of food and things that I like to do. So, and just random rants about how the industry could be better.
Well, again, thank you so much for being a part of this episode, and I hope everybody listening has had fun with as much as I have. And yeah, stay tuned as we'll talk to many more disabled and neurodivergent people in the industry. So make sure you keep on listening.
Thanks very much.
Thanks again, Lee, for being a fantastic guest on DNA of Games. As always, make sure you follow to get all the latest episodes from DNA of Games. I'll see you next time.